Brought to you by BASF. We create chemistry.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week on the podcast, I have a very special guest. His name is Louis Navalier, and he is best known as a stock picker and newsletter writer, as well as an asset manager running about $2.5 billion at Navalier & Company. If you were a financial television viewer in the 90s or 2000s, you very much probably saw Louis on TV discussing the markets, talking about how and why he picks various small cap stocks and his approach of using both quantitative and behavioral information in order to make stock selections. No less an authority than the Hulbert Financial Digest named one of his newsletters as the top performing stock selecting newsletter of the past 20 years. And although we all know that past performance is no guarantee of future returns, what I found so fascinating about my conversation with Louis was the approach he took to selecting stocks and how that grew out of a project that he began in college. What is so interesting is Navalier & Company is pretty much the only job he's ever had right out of school. In college, he was working on a project to try and find a cheaper way to put together a S&P 500 substitute. In other words, match the performance of the S&P 500, but using less stocks in order to keep your costs down. And unfortunately, they were unable to do that. They ran into a problem in that the index that they were putting together kept outperforming the S&P 500. And so based on the research that had gone into that, he launched Navalier & Company. He launched his own newsletter right out of school, was pretty successful right off the bat, and has grown it into quite the successful business. So with no further ado, here is my conversation with Louis Navalier.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
I have a very special guest. His name is Louis Navalier. He is the founder of Navalier & Associates. And if you have been involved in the markets for any length of time, you certainly have to be familiar with Mr. Navalier. He is well regarded as both a stock picker and a long-term investor. He started a newsletter in 1980, which the Hulbert Financial Digest called his Emerging Growth Newsletter, as the number one performer over a 20-year period, looking from 1985 to 2005. In 1987, he began managing assets for individuals. His office currently runs more than $2.5 billion. If you look at the period from 1985 through 2008, following the advice of our guest, you would have seen gains of over 2,000% versus the S&P 500 index, which had an increase of barely 869%. Louis Navalier, welcome to Bloomberg.
It's great to be here.
So I am familiar with your career for a long time. You were a fixture on the media in the 1990s and beyond, but your career kind of started unusually. You began in 1980, deep into a multi-decade bear market. What made you in 1980 say, "I know, let's go buy equities"?
Well, prior to 1980, actually, when I was in college, I was building index products. Mm-hmm. And I had access to Wells Fargo's computers, and index funds hadn't taken off then, but they were starting up. So we were trying to figure out how many stocks we needed to mirror the S&P 500.
And the obvious answer wasn't 500, can we do it with less and get the same
correct
returns?
Correct. It's all the tracking and correlation. Anyway, mm-hmm. I figured I needed 332 stocks. So I was very proud of this 332 stock portfolio. designed to track the S&P, but I have to admit to you, I was a failure. It started to beat the market, which was not the objective.
That's tracking error in the right direction.
Correct. So I learned that I was lied to. There are anomalies on Wall Street. There are high alpha stocks. So I went out to document these anomalies. And originally I started in small cap, and I'm still highly ranked there, but I'm predominantly a large cap manager right now.
Because I remember you as a small cap stock picker from the 1990s and really a quant before we use the term quant. Is that a fair statement?
That's correct. Our quant is just basically designed to find great risk-adjusted performance and also to lock in on the fundamental anomalies that everybody's trying to identify. So we're a little different than most quants. Most quants nowadays just want to front-run order flow, whether it's the hedge funds front-running the HFT order flow and just riding. It's kind of like surfing. Mm-hmm. And then there's the quants that basically front-run the Russell rebalancing every year. So at the end of June, Russell does all its rebalancing. That's a huge deal for all the tracking managers because they want to be ahead of the rebalancing, and the ETFs come in and pop everything. So my quant is totally different. I just want great risk-adjusted performance. As things get volatile, we tiptoe out, and I have to make sure they're always fundamentally superior. But what Wall Street wants fundamentally is changing. And that's the fun part of what we do is what we do is called behavioral finance. We lock in what's working on Wall Street, and we score the stocks on that criteria. And then we tweak our models quarterly.
So let's talk about those fundamental anomalies. What is a fundamental anomaly? And then how can an investor profit from that?
Well, we actually put all the research free on our websites, both on the publishing side and our management company site. But we have a dividend grader and a stock grader there. The dividend grader is mostly about return on equity, cash flow, sustainability, increasing dividends. Well, when you get to the stock grader, it's things like sales growth, margin expansion, earnings stability, earnings momentum, cash flow, return on equity, analyst earnings revisions, earnings surprises. Now, those aren't just all the criteria. We test. And when you get to small cap, surprises are a bigger deal, and so is momentum. When you get to large cap, stability is a bigger deal. Okay.
And that's interesting.
So you have different rules in different neighborhoods. And
those fundamental rules sound somewhat similar, not identical, but somewhat similar to what the marketers these days are calling smart beta. Is that a accurate assessment?
Sure. I have a smart beta ETF with Oppenheimer. I've had it for years. And that ETF happens to be sales weighted, rebalanced every quarter. So they basically took our top 100 A-rated stocks and we rebalanced quarterly to it. The thing with any smart beta product is what does it cost you to get in and out?
Sure.
Okay. And in the ETF world, you got to be careful because ETFs can have premiums to get in and discounts to get out. So you got to be really careful of the rebalancing costs. So I think some of the smart beta products aren't as successful as they should be because of the actual trading costs to get in and out.
It's just the traditional drag of taxes, expenses, turnover costs, et cetera. Is that the problem? Or do you mean buying the ETF itself trading at a discount or premium to its NAV?
That last point.
Ah, there you
see,
go.
See, Stanford, UCLA, and Arneson University came out with a study last year that said that ETFs cost more to buy and sell than stocks. It was scandalous. Everybody says, they don't cost anything. They're free. These are nice people. No.
There's an internal expense ratio that reflects all these costs.
Correct. But the specialist on the exchange likes to charge you a premium and likes it when you buy and likes to charge you a discount when you sell. And then shortly after that study came out, we had August 24th. And what happened on the morning of August 24th, 1,278 stocks couldn't be priced because they hit the little circuit breakers on the stock exchange. When they dropped more than 5%, they slowed the trading down. And for some reason, the specialists on the exchange kept trading ETFs even though they couldn't price the stocks. So you had all these big liquid ETFs being discounted at a shocking level. And so the ETF industry still has to deal with this. There's a big SEC investigation into this. But this is a big problem. And we're not anti-ETF, but we basically want everybody to know that when they turn the liquidity off of the market, don't sell your ETF.
I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My special guest today is Louis Navalier. He is best known as a small cap stock picker. These days, he's a big cap manager, a quantitative fundamental analyst and newsletter writer, as well as running $2.5 billion. Let's start out with a little bit of your academic undergraduate work and talk about your brand of quantitative analysis. So you're at Cal State. You're doing this research project to mimic the S&P 500. What makes you as a young kid say, hey, I think I could beat the market?
I didn't. I'm basically from Berkeley, California. Mm-hmm. I'm fully trained in socialism. I was taught that we're all supposed to earn the same amount of money.
If we don't, at least we share it with,
correct.
With
everybody else. But the reason we're all supposed to earn the same amount of money, we're all supposed to index, is because if we don't, we'll have create social unrest. Mm-hmm. And so for, you know, peace, love, harmony, we're all supposed to just blindly follow each other and buy this then index.
However, Jack Bogle would disagree with you, but... Go on.
I have no problem debating with Mr. Bogle. I respect him highly. But the real issue is that indexing evolved because they passed a law called ERISA. Mm-hmm. And ERISA says we need to match this benchmark to cover our butt. So basically, that's why indexing evolved. And of course, they started with the S&P. And they've created monsters. Okay. To be honest with you, if you go back to the go-go 90s, the big stocks are getting bigger because of the cap weight in the S&P. Just before the bubble burst in March of 2000, 54% of the S&P was in seven giant tech stocks. The issue I have with indexing and people that just blindly buy baskets of stocks, they have no idea what they're buying fundamentally, okay?
So let me push back on you a little bit. Didn't we see something similar in the late 60s with the Nifty 50, where the names that everybody knew, they were household names, they were all doing great, and all the managers used that as their benchmark and everyone piled in to the same 50 stocks, which ultimately collapsed. You had the 57% drop from 73 to 74. Is that very different than what took place in the late 90s, early 2000s?
It's exactly the same thing, except in the go-go 90s, it was concentrated in fewer stocks. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we had the whole FANG issue last year, okay,
right,
where the top 10 stocks in the S&P 500 did better than the other 490, but Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Google... overpowered it. And actually, that was an ETF story. You see, the equally weighted ETFs got mm-hmm. hit so hard in August, some of the big wirehouses said, get the hell out of these things, go back to cap weighted.
Right.
So as they paraded out of equal...
Usually at just the wrong time.
Correct. As they paraded out of equal into cap in the last 4 months of the year, they made the big stocks bigger. As we started this year, I'm not anti-FANG, but I was especially anti-Netflix mm-hmm. because... It was over 400 times earnings at the beginning of the year. Its earnings were forecasted to slide. So I wrote everybody to stay away, even though it was number one performer. I had some issues, valuations issues with Amazon, but I've since done an about face because I was very impressed with Amazon's first quarter, making money in the cloud, taking on Netflix, and actually they're even taking on Apple. Mm-hmm. If you buy an Apple TV, you can't get Amazon Prime because they have
no
their
app,
own device.
Trust me, I'm aware of
yeah,
that.
Yeah. So, but... You know, bubbles are created by these indices. I would respectfully argue that Tesla's valuation was largely caused by the QQQ. When Oracle left the QQQ, they put in Tesla and it couldn't handle the money. And so you have to realize getting added to some of these baskets is the greatest thing that ever happens to some of these companies. Mm-hmm. But the market right now is just too darn narrow to buy the baskets.
So you don't think Netflix at 400 times earnings? You don't think they're going to grow into that valuation?
No, I don't.
And Amazon has been overvalued, I think, forever. Is that a fair statement?
That is correct. So let me just walk you through Amazon because I did an about face on it because mm-hmm. I'm, I guess, slightly bipolar about it.
By the way, I'm a huge fan of both companies as a consumer, not necessarily as an
correct.
Investor.
And my family does the same. We both subscribe to them. So here's my issue with Amazon. Last year, it hit almost 1,000 times trailing earnings. It lost money the first three quarters. The fourth quarter earnings were a disaster, 38% below analyst estimates. The best thing I could say about Amazon late last year was trading at 200 times forecasted earnings. When I saw the first quarter results, I did an about face. First, they surprised. They're making a lot of money in cloud computing. Mm-hmm. They are taking on Netflix and programming. You may know they paid those Top Gear guys to leave the BBC.
Ton of money.
Only
they kind of had left. They were on the way out of the BBC.
They got
anyway.
Fired and they landed at Amazon. But the $250 million is pretty good for three guys. I realize it has a production team and a budget on top of that.
They have a ton of great programs. Yeah. Man in the High Tower is one, and then there's Catastrophe. There's a whole run. They've become must-see
correct,
TV.
Correct. And when you buy a Sony TV, you have an Amazon Prime app on it.
Built right in.
Built in. You can't get that app again on the Apple TV. So their devices, they think is better than the Apple TV, and I'll let them slug it out with Apple. But the other thing they got going for them, other than taking on Netflix and Apple, is in that cloud computing. They are continuing to dominate. Everyone can't wait to have their drone delivery. They're going to start it first in the UK. You do have to put out a little mat for your drone delivery because...
That's how it hones in on it?
Correct. And so if the dog gets it or if the sprinklers get it, it's your fault. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, but you have to have a mat.
You know, I was reluctant to join Prime until a couple of years ago. I finally joined Amazon Prime, and now I don't even think about something. You need it, you twitch, you buy it, it's there in 2 days. And half the time, it's not there in 2 days, it's there in a day. It's so they're onto something. If one day they figure out how to make money, they're going to be really big.
Well, they finally figured it out, and that's why I've done an about face, and now they're surprising, they're capturing market share. And, you know, Wall Street is desperate for sales growth. When the second quarter earnings come out, it's going to be the sixth quarter in a row of negative sales in the S&P, largely because the multinationals and commodity stocks are hurt by the strong dollar. So anything that has positive sales growth is an oasis at this moment.
So we're no longer going to be able to use weak oil as an excuse for that, because oil is now hovering between 45 and 50. When it was under $30, it was easy to say, hey, oil has collapsed. But now seems to be moving back towards a profitable...
Correct. And the energy companies are doing well because natural gas prices are up. This little heat wave we're having is helping. However,
for electricity generation.
Yes. However, I have to say this. Oil always goes up in the spring and then always goes down in the fall. The inventories in America have tightened up. However, they're still higher than they were last year. They're higher than they are historically. Rotterdam in Europe is full. We can't put any more oil there. They're still storing oil in tankers with nowhere to go.
Right.
And so we still have a glut. Oil demand's going up globally, but the supply went up faster.
Iraq is online. Iran is online. And the U.S. fracking is just going crazy.
Correct. And what's happening is that Iraq is the big player. If I have a chart when I do seminars that shows where all the production's coming from.
They're the marginal editor to supply.
And Iraq is much bigger than all the fracking that we've got. But now you got Iran coming online, just depends on the tankers, and everybody's trying to outdo each other. So we're not going to know where oil is to September.
I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My special guest today is Louis Navalier. He is a quant, money manager, stock picker, newsletter writer. He has been... actually running cash for almost 30 years, and it's been in the business for longer than that. Let's jump right into the whole idea of mutual funds and ETFs. You're an advisor to a number of funds and a number of ETFs. What are some of the disadvantages of those two structures, and what are some of the advantages?
Well, I think I should just tell you why I invest in them personally.
Sure.
Okay. I married a Canadian. She has money in the Caymans and a trust. We have to report to the IRS. We're not allowed to buy U.S. funds over there, so I buy my ETF with Oppenheimer over there. I think that ETF's fine if you want to buy and hold. It is not meant to trade. The spreads are still a little bit too wide. As it gets more liquid, maybe that'll change. But I think ETFs are better for buy and hold investing than trading because of that academic study that ETFs cost more to buy and sell. And then ETFs seem to have some liquidity issues during flash crashes, things like that. Mm-hmm. So buy and hold is fine. Trading, no. Now, over 90% of my personal money is in funds. So why do I do that? Well, I do it for a very selfish reason. I sold a big chunk of my business a few years ago at a cash event. And so I have a lot of taxable money in the market. When I seed a mutual fund and then I run around and grow it because people like me or whatever, something happens. What happens is the assets pouring in the fund dilute the taxes. Mm-hmm. So I run to places like New York and Los Angeles, and I tell everybody that New Yorkers don't have to move to Florida, that people in LA don't have to move to Nevada, just invest in one of my growing funds because you won't pay your fair share of taxes. If I grow a fund tenfold in a fiscal year, we will only pay 10% of the taxes we should. If I grow it fivefold, we'll only pay 20. So this is a function of mutual fund accounting. So I purposely seed funds with my own money, and then I promote them and try to get them to grow so I can better compound my money and help people stay in Los Angeles and New York.
So does that technique only work when you have funds growing rapidly, or would that work with any fund that's seeded and subsequently grows?
That is correct. I left a fund company that I'd been with for 17 years as a sub-advisor. And I left them last year at the end of the first quarter, and I was proud I was top 1%. But the tax time bomb that went off in that fund was just devastating.
Really?
And so basically, when funds shrink, they become tax time bonds. When they grow, they're tax efficient. And so that's why I've seeded funds with my own money. And they're all new, and they're all not that big. But I'm having a ball, and I hope people don't think bad about me that I'm helping them compound their money faster. But let's just say, for argument's sake, Hillary does become president, mm-hmm. and she gets her way, and we have to wait 6 years for long-term capital gains.
As opposed to 3 years.
Well, 1 year on stocks, it's 12 months in a day. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is that will help my business.
No, what I mean is there was a proposal that it was a three-year wait for long-term capital gains. Versus 1 year and a day today.
Well, whatever, if they lengthen it.
6 years is, I haven't heard 6 years, so you said that and my jaw dropped.
This is when she was running against Bernie and was, it was the original proposal. But if she's modified, that's a good sign. Of course, her husband cut capital gains, so yes. Maybe they should talk to each other about this.
So. You know, the traditional politics is you run to either extreme and then
Correct.
Pivot to the middle.
Correct.
I don't think anybody has mentioned that to the Donald, pivot to the middle. I assume by the time this airs, he will have begun that pivoting process. She's early stages of that.
Gotcha.
But 6 years is a ridiculous period of time for long-term capital.
That's correct. And the bottom line is people are stressed over taxes. You know, I'm originally from California, and I just see the stress in everybody's face over there. And the steps they go to avoid paying taxes is quite interesting.
So let's talk about that. You're a multi-state sort of guy. Your offices, so Navalier & Associates listed in Nevada, correct?
Correct. Our ops compliance trading's in Nevada. I still have a home there.
All right. And you live in Florida?
I live in the Palm Beach area.
So you only like sunny places. I can't argue with that.
But I do have our private client group in New York City. I have our publishing business in Rockville, Maryland. But basically, tax-free states are very interesting places. Mm-hmm. Reno's a fascinating place because Reno has the Schwab office there. The last I saw was the biggest in the world. Shanghai's number two.
Really?
And what it is in California, barely 3,000 people pay half that state's taxes. So what they do is a lot of people like to put their money in Nevada, buy a home in Lake Tahoe or in the hills somewhere.
Right.
And then they drive back to California. And as long as they don't spend more than 5 months there, they can live in California and not have to pay that 13.3%.
5 months in New York, it's 6 months to the day. If you're here 6 months in a day,
correct.
You owe the full ride.
Correct. New York will hunt you down the rest of your life, and that's uh-huh. that. But
and it was a big case. Someone literally, a plane made an unscheduled landing for 30 minutes and then took off after it refueled. They counted that as the day.
Of course.
They actually lost in the New York lost in court, but that's how much they're going after the 6 months yeah. rule. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My special guest today is Louis Navalier. He is a quant and stock picker, managing about $2.5 billion across the United States. Let's talk a little bit about modeling and quants. What do you think people misunderstand about the idea of using mathematics to evaluate and manage assets?
Well, I think the main thing that people should realize is a lot of the quants are basically doing it on order flow. So they're the nose on the dog versus the tail on the dog. Mm-hmm. And whether they're trying to trade ahead of the Russell realignment, a tracking manager, or whether they're trying to surf the HFT systems, the high frequency trading systems in that order flow. That's a lot of the hedge funds do that. In my case, it's about getting great risk adjusted performance. My system at this moment says Facebook is safer than Kroger. Mm-hmm. That may not be intuitive to you, but that's what it is. And if you charted both, you'd see it. So obviously, there's some more buying pressure under Facebook than there is Kroger. We know that Kroger's a lower PE and all that kind of stuff. So that's the first step of quant. But then I basically I score my stocks on various fundamental criteria that are very, very important because they're influencing all the order flow on Wall Street. And there are quarters where earnings don't work, but I can tell you they're working the last couple of quarters. Mm-hmm. And I go into every earnings season locked and loaded with fundamentally superior stocks, and I really enjoy earnings season. So I'm a little old school. You know, I do meet a lot of 40-year-olds that think I'm nuts for doing fundamentals, okay? Yeah. And these are gatekeepers at big firms, okay? I have a kid that goes to Stanford that's been highly recruited by some of the hedge funds to build the algorithmic models to basically a trade-off the HFT systems and adapt. He thinks he's never taken an accounting class. He wonders why I do fundamentals. Okay. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm not one of those quants. I'm a tax efficient quant. I hold stocks for over five quarters on average. I get predominantly long-term gains. The interesting thing about our models nowadays is dividend growth has invaded all our models because the S&P yields more than treasuries. Mm-hmm. The dividends were cut in the first quarter, 84% were in the energy sector, and the companies that are still boosting the dividends when others are cutting are an oasis. Mm-hmm. And of course, we've had this huge bond rally, and so dividends look a lot better nowadays, and of course, they are tax efficient by and large.
So when we look at the world of dividend stocks, how impactful has the Fed's policy of zero interest rates been to that sector of the universe?
The Fed is caused this. The Fed is not driving the bus anymore. I am extremely frustrated by the Fed. I don't know why they have to. Like in December, they told us inflation's coming back. The economy's going to be strong, so we're going to have four rate increases. Then in March, they said, economy's not as strong as we thought. Inflation isn't here yet. We only have two rate increases. And of course, Janet Yellen made it very clear we're going to have one or no rate increases the other week after the FOMC minutes. Our Fed, I personally think they're manipulated by Goldman. Okay, mm-hmm. There's a lot of Goldman economists that are chummy with the Fed economists, and maybe by getting
a little
the
bit
Fed
of a revolving door there.
Well, obviously the Fed economists would like to work at Goldman. Okay. Right.
And you have the New York Fed chief or the head of research, a former
absolutely.
Person,
and by the way, Dudley? Janet Yellen, in front of her congressional testimony the other day, pointed out that the private economists say this. Okay, so now she's now quoting the private economists. The truth is, there's a lot of money around the world, and with negative yields in Germany, Japan, Switzerland, money's going to keep pouring in the United States as right. long as we have higher rates than the rest of the world, as long as our currency is relatively stable, and as long as our economy is relatively decent. And I would make an argument that this strong dollar environment that has been haunting the United States and crushing corporate profits for the multinationals and commodity stocks is going to continue until our rates are as low as everybody else. And our Fed is not driving the bus. You know, under Bernanke, it was incredible. He spoke at the London School of Economics with Mervyn King in the audience mm-hmm. and Draghi, and he said, I didn't just save the world. I didn't save the U.S. I saved the world. But he, Draghi, Mervyn King all went to MIT together.
Right.
But now we have Mr. Carey, a Canadian running the Bank of England. King retired. Yellen replaced Bernanke. She went to Yale. And there's no coordination with the central bank activity anymore. And so the market forces are really driving this. And of course, the low interest rate environment is causing buybacks to explode.
Mm-hmm. My cheap borrowing, go out and buy all the stock.
Absolutely.
You want,
now it's exploding internationally because the rates are even lower there. My average large cap stock retires 6.2% of its float a year.
That's amazing. You know, when you look at that, what you describe as coordinated, it's a little out of phase because you had the U.S. start and finish their QE. And just as Japan was starting their QE, and they're a couple of years into it, and finally Europe is catching, maybe this QE thing is a thing. So the conditions that have existed for the past 5 years, you're suggesting this is going to continue to go on
absolutely.
For the foreseeable future.
I don't know how the ECB, the European Central Bank, gets out of this mess. They're not only at minus 40 basis points. When they boosted their quantitative easing by 20 billion euros a month, the big thing wasn't the money. It says, now you can buy corporate debt.
Yeah, they move beyond just driving rates lower.
And Japan has always put their quantitative easing in all kinds of funny places. At least
they've been buying stock as well. They're cute.
They buy real estate. They buy everything. It's just amazing. It's, of course, it's in a REIT over there. But it's this worldwide limbo contest. And I would respectively argue that our rates are going to be driven lower by all the foreign. Where I live in Florida, I'm the only American on my street. It's all Russians and Europeans now. And they've all bought homes in Florida. And they basically,
is that to move money out of the country? Or
absolutely.
Is that because
the Russians are up 60% in the last few years because the ruble went to pot. And then the Europeans are probably up 20%+. This has nothing to do with real estate. This is just currency.
If you look at the West Coast, if you look at Seattle, Portland, Vancouver especially, it's a lot of China money trying to get out of the country. There are these brand new office buildings in Vancouver completely sold and still mostly empty. The opposite of the... Remember the see-through office towers in Dallas during the oil collapse in the 80s? Mm-hmm. This is see-through residential towers in Vancouver due to Chinese money fleeing?
Well, my son who's at Stanford has a lot of Chinese friends, and he's met all their parents because when their kids went to school here, they happened to come here. Mm-hmm. Apparently, it's not a problem getting the United States if you bring some assets. And I know we're in an election year. I'm not running for anything, but if I was, I would recommend we invite 100 million new foreigners with about 2 million each, okay, to come to America.
And sounds like a plan.
And that's what happened to Canada. Canada was broke 30 years ago. They doubled the size of their country by letting in people with money. Mm-hmm. Okay, so one thing you can say about America is at least our immigration is controversial, but we are letting a lot of very talented people in with money. And of course, there is this corruption crackdown in China that seems to be expediting it. Interestingly, the corruption crackdown isn't in the province where the president of China is from.
Not a terrible coincidence. So, So as a quant, do you look at other quants? Do you see what other people are doing? You mentioned the HFT things. I look at someone like let's use Cliff Asness as an example, who publishes white paper, and he's a pretty big factor model sort of guy. He likes value and momentum. What other quants do you pay attention to, or at least find it interesting to read?
I think the most readable people now from a publishing point of view are the folks at Bespoke. I think they mm-hmm. do the most in-your-face, graphically shocking research.
Compelling images that really tell a story.
Yeah, and I think they do a wonderful job. Are they the pure quants like me with their databases online? No, but they are very academic. They like to talk about what's working on Wall Street. They love to put a historical perspective on stuff. We at our management company have a weekly free thing called Market Mail, and we have a historian there because it's just fascinating to always look back and mm-hmm. see where we're at. But no, you never stop learning, and that's the fun part of our business. I will admit that the new quants trade a lot more than I do. Okay, mm-hmm. but that's an order flow thing. I'm still kind of an old school behavioral finance fundamental guy. And but I respect anything that works.
Mm-hmm. You know, the Bespoke guys very much remind me of Jim O'Shaughnessy and the What Works on Wall Street. It's the same. Let's just look in the numbers and see if there's a something that's changing that's worth figuring out. Well, whether it's fundamental valuation or what have you, that book was really seminal for that approach.
Sure. But I think what everybody has to realize is the market mutates. And I think the way I like to explain it is Bill Walsh used to be a good football coach because he had a system that no one had. And then it stopped working because it went all over the league. You know what I mean? Everybody figured out that West Coast offense. And that's how Wall Street is. Whether it's cash flow, prices, sales, earnings momentum, surprises, whatever the factors are people are locking in on, it will only work till everybody does it. So what we do is we figure out what's working, and as the factors start to break down and get more volatile, they get trimmed from our models. And then we stress test everything. This is the fun part of what Navalier does. At the end of each quarterly earnings season, we step in, we update the models, and we tweak them to lock in on what's working.
So how often are those models trading? How often are you rebalancing, and how often are you making major shifts in the holdings?
Well, the models are stress tested on a 1 in 3 year basis at the end of each earnings season. Okay, mm-hmm. So they're being upgraded right now because we're about to go into another earnings season. Then the models are run every weekend. Okay, we actually do our research on weekends. And then our managers have what the models recommend for the next week. And we pretty much follow the models. And the only time we'll override them if there's merger news or something like that or liquidity events. But we fly in instruments, and then, of course, we have optimization models to weight everything to get it as smooth as possible. One of the great things about the modeling nowadays is because dividend stocks zig when growth stocks zag, you can mix dividend growth with real growth stocks and really reduce the volatility. So our trademark has become really as a good risk-adjusted manager. Lower beta, lower max drawdown, lower standard deviation. And we're immensely proud of that. And then you can further do that by putting a tactical overlay on it if you want. But again, we're obsessed with risk control. That starts with a quant. We always have fundamentally superior stocks. I don't have to worry when things are flying around because I know I got good earnings next quarter. And then, but as individual stocks become increasingly risky, I will trim them or replace them with safer stocks. And so that's the main reason we're selling. We most of the stuff we sell is actually pretty good. We just mm-hmm. got to sell with something that's better, that'll have less volatility, and add to the portfolio. So we're running the portfolios like you'd run a sports team. So if you're on my team and you lose a step because, you know, you're getting old and, you know, I'll throw you off the team. Or if you're young, you party too hard and you lose a step for that, and I'll throw you off the team for that. Usually I'll cut your minutes or I'll throw you off the team. Mm-hmm. So that's how optimization works. We're always trying to build, get the smoothest, steadiest ride out there. And we're immensely proud of that.
So if people want to find out more about Navalier or read any of your research, where's the best place for them to go?
Well, there's two sites. I'd recommend Navalier.com, the management company. Sign up for something called Market Mail, which is a free commentary. It comes out every Tuesday. My newsletter is NavalierGrowth.com. We keep those businesses separate. But we have free databases on both sites. And start playing around with our free databases. And, of course, you're welcome to call us anytime you'd like more information.
Louis, thank you so much for doing this. Can you stick around a little bit?
Of course.
We'll keep plowing through some of these questions. If you have enjoyed this conversation, be sure and stick around for our podcast extras, where we keep the tape rolling and continue chatting about all things quant, modeling, and stock selections. Be sure and check out my daily column on Bloomberg.com. Follow me on Twitter at Ritholtz. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
Brought to you by BASF. We create chemistry.
I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My special guest today is Louis Navalier. He is a quant and stock picker, managing about $2.5 billion across the United States. Let's talk a little bit about modeling and quants. What do you think people misunderstand about the idea of using mathematics to evaluate and manage assets?
Well, I think the main thing that people should realize, a lot of the quants are basically doing it on order flow. So they're the nose on the dog versus the tail on the dog. Mm-hmm. And whether they're trying to trade ahead of the Russell realignment, a tracking manager, or whether they're trying to surf the HFT systems, the high frequency trading systems in that order flow, that's a lot of the hedge funds do that. In my case, it's about getting great risk-adjusted performance. My system at this moment says Facebook is safer than Kroger. Mm-hmm. That may not be intuitive to you, but that's what it is. And if you charted both, you'd see it. So obviously, there's some more buying pressure under Facebook than there is Kroger. We know that Kroger's a lower PE and all that kind of stuff. So that's the first step of quant. But then I basically try to I score my stocks on various fundamental criteria that are very, very important because they're influencing all the order flow on Wall Street. And there are quarters where earnings don't work, but I can tell you they're working the last couple quarters. Mm-hmm. And I go into every earnings season locked and loaded with fundamentally superior stocks, and I really enjoy earnings season. So I'm a little old school. You know, I do meet a lot of 40-year-olds that think I'm nuts for doing fundamentals, okay? Yeah. And these are gatekeepers at big firms, okay? I have a kid that goes to Stanford that's been highly recruited by some of the hedge funds to build the algorithmic models to basically trade off the HFT systems and adapt. He thinks he's never taken an accounting class. He wonders why I do fundamentals. Okay. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm not one of those quants. I'm a tax efficient quant. I hold stocks for over five quarters on average. I get predominantly long term gains. The interesting thing about our models nowadays is dividend growth has invaded all our models because the S&P yields more than treasuries. Mm-hmm. The dividends were cut in the first quarter, 84% were in the energy sector, and the companies that are still boosting the dividends when others are cutting are an oasis. Mm-hmm. And of course, we've had this huge bond rally, and so dividends look a lot better nowadays, and of course, they are tax efficient by and large.
So when we look at the world of dividend stocks, how impactful has the Fed's policy of zero interest rates been to that sector of the universe?
The Fed is caused this. The Fed is not driving the bus anymore. I am extremely frustrated by the Fed. I don't know why they have to. Like in December, they told us inflation's coming back. The economy's going to be strong, so we're going to have four rate increases. Then in March, they said, economy's not as strong as we thought. Inflation isn't here yet. We only have two rate increases. And of course, Janet Yellen made it very clear we're going to have one or no rate increases the other week after the FOMC minutes. Our Fed, I personally think they're manipulated by Goldman. Okay, mm-hmm. There's a lot of Goldman economists that are chummy with the Fed economists, and maybe by getting
a little
the
bit
Fed,
of a revolving door there.
Well, obviously, the Fed economists would like to work at Goldman. Okay.
Right. And you have the New York
Fed chief or the head of research, a former
absolutely. Oh, and by the way, Janet Yellen, in front of her congressional testimony the other day, pointed out that the private economists say this. Okay, so now she's now quoting the private economists. The truth is, there's a lot of money around the world, and with negative yields in Germany, Japan, Switzerland, money's going to keep pouring in the United States as right. long as we have higher rates than the rest of the world, as long as our currency is relatively stable, and as long as our economy is relatively decent. And I would make an argument that this strong dollar environment that has been haunting the United States and crushing corporate profits for the multinationals and commodity stocks is going to continue until our rates are as low as everybody else. And our Fed is not driving the bus. You know, under Bernanke, it was incredible.
So if people want to find out more about Navalier or read any of your research, where's the best place for them to go?
Well, there's two sites. I'd recommend Navalier.com, the management company. Sign up for something called Market Mail, which is a free commentary. It comes out every Tuesday. My newsletter is NavalierGrowth.com. We keep those businesses separate. But we have free databases on both sites. And start playing around with our free databases. And, of course, you're welcome to call us anytime you'd like more information.
Louis, thank you so much for doing this. Can you stick around a little bit?
Of course.
We'll keep plowing through some of these questions. If you have enjoyed this conversation, be sure and stick around for our podcast extras, where we keep the tape rolling and continue chatting about all things quant, modeling, and stock selections. Be sure and check out my daily column on Bloomberg.com. Follow me on Twitter at Ritholtz. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. Welcome to the podcast. Louis, thank you so much for doing this. I said earlier, and I really didn't get a chance to elaborate on this in the intro, I've been following you and your methodology and how you approach looking at stocks for a long time. It's funny, I'm the old man in my office, and we have a lot of young guys, 20-something, 30-something. They say, who's the guest this week? And I knew it was coming. I said, Louis Navalier. And they looked at me and said, who? I go back, look at some old barons, go pull some of So did you ever do Rukeyser? Am I remembering?
I did it. Frank Capriello was the
late in the in the cycle. But you were a fixture on financial television for many, many years. And I'm always astonished when the kids don't know who came before them. It's just search Navalier/stock picking and you'll find out all you need to know. So before we get to our standard questions, there's so much stuff here that I didn't get through last time. Let's plow through some of this. I'm fascinated by the idea that undergraduate or graduate in 1980?
I graduated from college in 78. And then I got my MBA in 79.
Okay,
and then I started the newsletter in June of 1980.
So I'm fascinated that here's a guy with an MBA 2 years from college, deep into one of the worst bear markets in generations, and you say, I know, let's go into the stock market. That's where the fun is. What motivated that? You had to have some inkling you were onto something before saying, here's a terrible industry. Let's join that.
Well, first of all, I had been building databases behind the scenes. I was fortunate to get access to mainframe computers in college from Wells Fargo.
Where was that?
It was Cal State Hayward, which is now called Cal State East Bay. But we were fortunate to get access to Wells Fargo's computers. So I'm old. You know, I had a slide rule. We used to punch cards. Anyway. So I figured out what was working, and then I built my own databases, and every stock was a card going through a TI programmable calculator.
Right.
So every weekend I would get barons, and I'd update everything and key it in, and I had my own database. But in 78, 79, and in the first few months, 1980, you had a big small cap rally, and then that bubble burst. Mm-hmm. But I knew there were anomalies on Wall Street. I could see them in small cap. And so I started in small cap, assuming that was the least efficient place. In fact,
that's how I first came to know you, is your rep was, hey, this is a great small cap stock picker.
Correct. And then my first letter was OTC Insight, later renamed MPT Review. It's now called Emerging Growth. The publishers like to rename us. But that's how it all evolved. And then this guy Holbert picked me up and said nice things about me, and that helped my career. And And so publishing's still a big thing. You know, we're very popular in the brokerage world. Mm-hmm. The way it works is if a stock goes up, it's their idea. If it goes down, it's my idea.
Of course.
There's a lot of folks out there that are trading off our portfolios. And it's somewhat stressful because we have a bit of a wake nowadays. So when we make a recommendation, there's a little blip on the stock. Uh-huh. And I'll be honest with you, Zacks has picked me up 85% of the time, so there's another blip. So this becomes an issue, but... you know, we do influence markets, but markets are also very fragile. So
it's funny. I spent the first half of my career on the sell side, and what you described right out of the broker handbook. Hey, you know, anything anybody else suggests, if it doesn't work out, it's that guy. But if it does work out, I'm the genius who brought it to you. So that is, I think, page one.
That's correct. And I meet clients that think I'm running their money. And then I can't find them on our system because their broker's running it.
Right.
But the broker pays for my newsletter, so I don't argue. Okay. And
you have a run of different newsletters, don't you?
Oh, gosh. I think we have six now. But
what do they typically cost for a year?
Well, we start everybody in Blue Chip Growth, which is our flagship. Mm-hmm. I think that's $249 a year. And then Emerging Growth is a little bit more. That's more small cap. Then we have something called Ultimate Growth, where we trade stocks that hold about 4 to 5 months, more for the pensions. And then if you get all three, you get Ultimate Growth. And now we have a family trust service, which follows my wife's, my mother-in-law's money, a little more conservative than Blue Chip, higher dividend yield, buy and dip, sell on the strength. That's kind of plays the range of the stocks. And then we have a new dividend service. You know, I should talk to you about, mention something. You know, we have... our stock grader, we're immensely proud of. We wrote a book on this.
What's the name of the book?
The Little Book That Makes You Rich with John Wiley.
Yep.
Yeah. And that introduced our stock grader. And that's all free in the public domain. We have a dividend grader service up there. And our dividend grader, believe it or not, has actually beaten our stock grader in the last 10 years. But mm-hmm. barely. Now, this locks in on dividend growth. Not high dividend growth.
Right.
And... when we merge the A-rated stocks in Dividend Grader with the A-rated stocks in Stock Grader, the rich results are incredible. But I only can find 3 to 4 stocks a month. Mm-hmm. So I'm actually at the stage of my life where I'm running out of capacity. I'm running out of places to put the money. And so we have very concentrated portfolios nowadays. And I can find that, you know, I can do better with an 18-stock portfolio than I can with a 37-stock portfolio.
Right.
The market
more
is so
risk, more volatility, but better performance.
Yeah, the market is shockingly narrow right now. Well, it's interesting you say risk, but my 18-stock portfolio is safer than 37 because it's the putting the dividend versus the growth stocks, and they're all low-risk stocks, but they move differently. Mm-hmm. So as long as we optimize them properly, but you're right. If I had an extraordinary event, or if I laid an egg in one of them, I probably
less
that would
diversification
happen.
Implies lower potential expected returns, more drawdowns. People seem to misuse the term volatility for risk. What I mean is, hey, we know what your expected returns are based on these characteristics of the holdings. What are the odds that we're not going to get those returns in any one year? What are the odds that we're going to have an outsized drawdown? That's the loose definition of risk I like to use.
Correct. And we can slice, you know, we have beta, max drawdown, standard deviation, we have unsystematic, we have all kinds of different ways to slice it. But the bottom line is, I'm actually safer today on 18 stocks than I'm on about 37. Mm-hmm. And I'm but that's the function of the optimization model, is blending the dividend growth with the growth stocks. But we really enjoy what we do. We see it our own products. We're one of the few managers that are willing to work for 10% of profits billable annually, no fixed fee.
And say that again. Let's go over that. So it's not 2 and 20, and it's not a straight 1%. It's we won't charge anything, and we'll just take 10% of the profits.
Net of all costs. Advisor, brokerage firm, everything. It's SEC Rule 205-3. The client must say they have a $2 million liquid net worth.
Right.
As long as they say they have that, we're willing to run their money for 10% of profits billable annually or a reasonable fixed fee. We have either or. Mm-hmm. So we really enjoy what we do. Our firm is increasingly being run more and more like a family office because we're very fortunate. And I think I married well and I sold some business at the right time. But the bottom line, we love what we do. We heavily invest in what we do. We're not as big as a Ron Barron or anybody like that.
Right.
But we really enjoy what we do.
And that gets reflected in the business. So let's go back to you launching a newsletter right out of grad school. What was the mood like on Wall Street in the early 1980s? That had to be, you know, we just had a double dip recession, 80 and 82.
inflation was teenage numbers. The 10-year bond, I think, was yielding 16%. Who the hell wants stocks?
Well, that was interesting. I was in San Francisco at the time, mm-hmm. and San Francisco was much less stressed out than
New York.
Because, you know, it's kind of la-la land out there.
Not anymore. I think San Francisco is more stressed out than New York these days.
Well, that's
good. Fights over Google buses, apartment rents, everything's gone up.
It's very stressful stepping over homeless people everywhere. But to make a long story short, this is at the end of the Volcker era.
And by the way, the homeless in California was Giuliani's gift from New York to California.
Oh, well.
That was our gift to the West Coast.
They mean well, but there's quite a few of them out there.
L.A., San Diego, the whole West Coast, all of California's. As a New Yorker who has seen the number of homeless tick up recently, mm-hmm. you know, if you remember in the 70s and 80s, homelessness in New York was terrible.
Yes.
That all changed once we started treating it like a mental health issue and not. You have the right to sleep in the park, and it's ticked up since Bloomberg left the mayoralty. It's ticked up a little bit, and I'm shocked every time I go to California by the sheer numbers.
I have a good friend, Bruce, impeccable dresser, beautiful wife, very successful gentleman. In the 80s, he had a slight crack cocaine problem. We always mm-hmm. wonder what was wrong with Bruce. He was sitting in the Tenderloin, and somebody bit his finger off.
Nice.
A human. I'm from the Bay Area. It's shocking to see people eat pigeons and things. So it's something
pigeons.
I don't want to see ever again. Do you know what I mean?
And yet California is not responding to this.
California is a fascinating place. You know, 20% of Californians don't have bank accounts. There's this huge cash economy there.
Okay? Really?
So, well, the other thing
is, isn't it true 20% of the drivers out there don't have insurance?
Well, it's...
Might be the same group.
You know, it's funny. It's... if you went to California DMV, they would say, don't blame us. They had Schwarzenegger's picture there because of the budget cuts. But
right. The
ski resorts got extra traffic because they had the mandatory layoffs. You know, I have the mandatory leave in California when they have budget problems. I have California employees because mm-hmm. I have some people who live in Truckee that work for me.
You're right near the border.
And I remember a few years ago, I said, I'm sorry about your paycheck. And this, what happened? Because they got less money. Well, California was broke, so they had more withholding taxes.
They just withheld more, figure we'll borrow it from the future.
And of course, you didn't file your tax return in time, you got an IOU. But they are benefiting from the new tech boom now, and I think they're okay. But going back to the cash economy that dominates Silicon Valley and a lot of other places and Los Angeles, you know, there is a theory that maybe the check cashing stores are more efficient than the banks, but the truth of the matter is there is a cash economy there,
uh-huh.
and they're very innovative, and it is what it is.
That has to be a large chunk of illegal immigrants, housekeepers, gardeners, whatever, who are getting paid in cash and don't show up on the balance sheets anywhere, and that's that part of the country.
It's a great country, and what can I say? And, I'm originally from Berkeley, and, you know, when you're in the pot business in Berkeley— you have to be nonprofit because you're doing this for the good of mankind, okay?
Right.
And they did arrest one of the Berkeley pot growers because he made too much money one year. They arrested him for capitalism, okay?
That's pretty hilarious.
It's, yeah.
So now that we have states like Colorado and Oregon and another two dozen states about to make marijuana, not just medical marijuana, but recreational marijuana fully legal, is that going to become an investable thesis anytime soon?
No, because you can't cash the money.
Can't bank.
So anytime you see a marijuana investment, unless it's an LED lighting to make the plants grow faster,
mm-hmm.
or hydroponics or some mechanical thing behind the scenes, I wouldn't invest in it. Okay.
And that's because of the federal law on banking doesn't allow them to actually put money in banking.
Correct. And what's happened in Vegas, because unfortunately, there are some people in Nevada that are slightly stoned, okay? in Vegas, it's all gone to the e-cigarettes.
Right.
Because they can't trace it. So
what do you mean the money has gone to e-cigarettes? In other words, they're selling e-cigs as well as...
They're getting their marijuana through the e-cigarettes, and they can't trace it. Well, if you smoked it or ate it, they could apparently trace it better. So the marijuana industry in Vegas has collapsed. Now, Vegas is a big LDS area. I mean,
is it legal? Is marijuana, is it recreational or medical in Nevada?
You know, that's a good question, but it's at every...
Because everything is legal in Vegas,
It's at every ski slope I've ever been to, so, even in Utah. So it is a performance-enhancing drug.
Apparently. By the way, Utah had an interesting solution to their homeless problem, is they said, we're spending X dollars a year on each individual homeless person. If we can spend less and solve the problem, we'll entertain any solution. And the solution someone came up with was, give them inexpensive apartments, pay for it. This way they get their meds, they have access to their whatever. And so far, Utah seems to have come up with the only solution that seems to be working. California should take a look at what they're doing and maybe even save some money along the way.
Yeah, you know, I go to some states that are very interesting, like Alabama is very church-oriented. You have to, you know, Wednesday night's church night. They better not catch you out going for dinner on Wednesday. For some reason, I'm in Alabama a lot. Obviously, Utah is very LDS. Nevada's very LDS as well. So I suspect
LDS as
the
in...
Latter-day Saints.
Oh, okay. I thought you were suggesting liberal Democratic socialists, and I'm like, I would think that's more California than Utah.
So
Mormons, LDS.
I suspect there's a bit of a church influence going on in Utah too. I would be shocked if there isn't. So we probably, you know, that. I don't know if that model will work everywhere, but we have to see how strong it's coming from the church versus somebody else. But kudos to them for, you know...
being a little creative and thinking outside the box and not just spending... You can't just throw money at problems. That doesn't solve them.
One thing I can tell you is in South Florida, where I happen to live, we have all the rehab places, and we have a lot of the second steps, and you go there. And it's funny, when I fly back to Florida, there are a lot of them are flying with me.
front of the plane?
They book them in the, because it's very expensive rehab. And, you know, they're all, you know, getting all their little drinks so they can have one last hit. You know, most of them are opiates, you know, Percocet and Oxycontin and all the legal drugs or whatever El Chapo was selling.
I don't think you could get Percodan. Yeah, I guess you could get Percocet. I had my wisdom teeth out between college and grad school, and they gave me a prescription of Percodan. I call that the best month of my life.
Yeah.
But at the end of the month, you're done. There was no... that seems to have changed these days.
Yeah, and it's a serious problem. We have a good friend we'll go unnamed who had a problem for 4 years with this. He had...
Really?
He thought he had teeth problems, but he had a little aneurysm in his head, and they had to open his head. In fact, Ben Carson almost cut on him. Ben was his second choice. And so they deal with his aneurysm, but he apparently liked Oxycontin for a while. And so he's back. He's fine. We're all reaching out to him to help him. And he's fine. He's mentally sharp as can be. But it's a happy place, apparently.
Apparently. You know, I don't mind the occasional mood altering drink or what have you, but it's a place to visit for vacation. It's not a place to live in on a permanent basis, but...
That's why we have to watch all our trading desks, okay?
Because that's a place to visit and not a place to... So let's go back to 1980, when you're coming out of grad school and launching the newsletters. Were you working in New York? Were you aware of the mood of Wall Street? Or
sure.
Did that... So how did that affect the way you looked at... The decision to let's launch a business right into the teeth of
this. Well, I was thinking of moving here, and I prayed around here, and then of course I had to get used to the weather. It was pretty hot when I was running around here, but I decided to work for myself, and I was originally sponsored by a little firm called Van Casper in San Francisco,
which is
part of Wells Fargo, and so all my managed accounts were going through there, and then I went in, started to work with other people and platforms, and we just want to take care of people and treat everybody like we treat ourselves. And, you know, in fact, I just had my SEC DOL audit, Department of Labor audit. And they walk into a grocery shop and they saw how much dividend management a lot of our clients had. And so I think I can't say the SEC was happy, but I was happy with the audit. It was not as long as I thought. And they brought the DOL lawyer there on loan to make sure that we do suitability. And we put everybody gets a mix that's suitable for them versus some canned mix. You know, I think if they caught any of us, you know, treating everybody, you know, putting the round client in the round slot and square. They don't like that. You have to literally listen to people, do what they want, and dial it in and change it as their needs change. So we're pretty proud of what we've done, and our private client group here in New York is growing rapidly because we're taking care of people.
So what was your take on the whole suitability versus fiduciary standard that the DOL rules changed? Do you have any thoughts on that? Or
I have no problem with it. I think the real problem is the conflicts we have out there. So I don't have a conflict because we either a low institutional fee or that incentive fee. But what's happened to our business, and I'll pick on my I'll pick on my daughter. So my daughter's a mutual fund wholesaler. She has a $4,000 a month budget. The guy she married used to give her fund business because he was wanted to show he loved her. Okay.
Okay.
Now that he's her husband, he just does iShares because at his firm he gets an extra 50 basis points to iShares over funds. One of the conflicts that's emerged in our business is the ETF wholesalers have more money than the fund wholesalers. And so there are what we call a pay-to-play system out there. And a lot of it's masked with intelligence that the firms say, well, in exchange for this money, we'll make you work more efficiently and tell you where you should go. Okay. So I don't pay-to-play anywhere. So this isn't my problem, but this is what the industry is dealing with. And a lot of people don't realize that when the ETFs are rebalanced every 90 days, that it's that if that ETF controls the specialist, the ETF might actually profit on it. So it's kind of like the bond business. So in the bond world, everybody will always give you everything with no fees, no transactions, because all the money's in the spread. People don't realize how big the spreads are in ETFs.
Or it's already a house holding and they're charging a markup. I used to have this discussion with people who would say, I don't understand who's paying bond managers. My guy at fill-in-the-blank wirehouse doesn't charge me for bonds. And I would always laugh and say, let me explain to you. There is no free lunch. Of course you're being charged. It's just not transparent or disclosed. You're not seeing. Either it's stuff, it's house inventory that they're selling to you as a markup, in which case they don't have to show it. Or you could drive a truck through that spread and they own it on one side and they're selling it to you on the other.
That's correct. And so what's happened is the asset gatherers on Wall Street, which dominate our business, are very good gathering assets, convincing everybody they have low fees, but people may not realize they make money on securities lending, which is legit.
Right.
They make money on, can make money on market making for the ETF through their specialist affiliate, which is legit if they don't hose them too much. But that's
just a little bit of hosing.
Well, this is what, so let's take some of the big robo programs. The robo programs, there are no management fees. That's correct. But if you read like page 14 of the disclosure, one of them, each ETF pays $250,000 a year to be in there. Well, why would you pay $250,000 a year if you're hardly getting any fees? Well, because your ETF is rebalanced every 90 days and the specialist affiliate could make a lot of money, especially if it's an equally weighted ETF.
And there's an internal expense ratio built in.
Correct,
you don't have to pay a fee to buy it. It's not like the old days of C shares. The fee is built in. You know, if you look at a number of custodians, there's a run of ETFs that they'll allow you to trade at no charge. And it's like, well, why is that? Because they have relationships when they're either constructing or deconstructing the individual shares and there's money to be made. They're happy just to have it there in-house.
And, you know, it's funny. I go to Europe and they do not like ETFs. The Bank of England told them not to do it. I have a friend that used to arbitrage between London and New York, went to jail for 3 years. Mr. Spister got him. And they're still arbing in Europe right now, okay?
Because there's a difference between the ETF and its holdings.
Correct.
So in the U.S., what's supposed to keep – those arbitrageurs are supposed to keep the price between the NAV and the ETF identical. And the way they do it is, hey, here's a market solution to not allowing these things to get out of whack. The financial incentive allows people to trade that and bring them into sync.
Right. And I don't mean to be too negative, but unfortunately, the SEC is behind. I can tell you what the SEC did wrong. When we had, first off, when they got rid of the 12B1 fees on mutual funds, okay, the firms figured out how to get paid even more, okay?
Right.
So actually the SEC caused this conundrum to exist. And when we had the flash crash in 2010, that 5-minute period, the SEC came in and broke every trade where somebody lost more than 40%. So they basically told every specialist, you can steal money until it hits 40%. And that's exactly what you saw on August 24th of 2015, okay? The circuit breakers hit. They couldn't price the stocks. BNY Mellon had a little pricing issue. And but there were ETF orders out there, and everybody looked at each other, and they dropped a bid and picked everybody off 32 to 35%. But they didn't pick off anybody. They picked off DVY, that iShares five-star ETF.
Right.
They picked off Guggenheim S&P Equal. They picked off a bunch of Vanguard Equal ETFs. And that's why the SEC did a scathing report, like, what in the hell is going on? And if I was the SEC and implementing this DOL thing, I would probably tell the ETF world, you better behave, okay? Because the spreads are too wide. ETFs do not trade in net asset value, okay? And this is a huge problem. And I have my own issues with Morningstar. Morningstar will show in August 24th, that month that the DVY only had a 1 basis point trade risk. But for some reason, it had a 53.3% range intraday, okay? So I would argue that Morningstar's not doing their math right, mm-hmm. okay? Because you can look at a chart, like on Bloomberg, and you see the risk. And then you look at Morningstar, and where's the risk? So there's a lot of things that need to be cleaned up. And this is going to be fixed really fast. But right now, those folks that run the exchanges are laughing at us. And every time there's an extraordinary event, they're going to make a lot of money.
Huh. That's really an interesting take. I can't say I disagree with the whole lot of that. So I want to get to our favorite few questions before they kick us out of here. But there are so many things I skip through before. Let's talk about geopolitical risk, Brexit, U.S. elections. Does any of that stuff matter to you? You think about that?
Sure. I mean,
how do you model for that sort of stuff?
Well, we have already seen this incredible rally in Europe because they briefly thought that Britain might stay, okay, because the tragic assassination of the member of parliament, and it kind of swung the polls. Now the polls are going the other way. And they're all on pins and needles. So there's a lot of cash on the sidelines ready to pour in if Britain stays. If Britain leaves, the dollar will have this incredible rally. Mm-hmm. It will pinch S&P earnings for the multinationals, commodities even more. It has profound ramifications. But if you look at the electric around the world, people seem to be a little ticked off. Nationalism is on its way back. And
we've seen that everywhere. Here and
even here. Even here. So we'll see what happens. I have Brits that work for me, and they've told me people know are voting to leave. But you know, we'll see what happens. You know, this also happened in Canada, and then they told the Quebecers how much they love right. each other. So maybe the folks in Brussels need to tell Britain how much they love them. You know.
So speaking of overseas, you run models both U.S. and international. When we look at the world of either value or small cap, we see those factors outperform even more overseas than they do in the U.S., at least developed ex-U.S. When you create a model for overseas stocks, do you do anything differently, or is it the same factors that you're applying, just tweaking them somewhat in a different balance?
Well, first of all, we have our hottest product this year is an emerging market product, and we're getting a lot of money in it. But I have to tell you, we've been pretty good on currencies. Mm-hmm. And the key is when you invest internationally, you better not get the currency wrong. And to demonstrate it, I'll give you an example where I made a mistake. Many years ago, I had the Coca-Cola bottler in Mexico. Mm-hmm. Because the,
I recall that.
The Coca-Cola bottler is, the average Mexican drinks 60 gallons of soft drink a year. By the way, it's better down there than it is here.
Because it's real cane sugar, yeah, exactly. Not high fructose corn syrup.
And
anytime I go to the islands, I buy Coca-Cola. It's delicious.
So it was a booming business, and I think the bottle, the distributor.
And before I forget, I'm sorry to interrupt. Before I forget, if you go into certain gourmet supermarkets in New York, like Whole Foods, you can buy a 4-pack of 10-ounce glass bottle Mexican Coke.
Excellent.
Which is made with cane sugar, not high fructose corn
excellent.
Syrup.
Excellent.
Sorry for interrupting.
But no, anyway, so booming business. And but if you drink 60 gallons of soft drink a year, as the average Mexican does, you might get diabetes.
Right.
So at that time, I had Novo Nordisk, the diabetes company. So I said, I am a great portfolio manager. I have this great bottler, and I have the diabetes company, and I have eliminated risk. Okay? One zigs, one zags.
Perfectly hedged for diabetes.
Until the Mexican peso went the wrong way,
and my trade
came and went. So the moral of the story is when you invest internationally, don't get the currency wrong. And,
Do you hedge currency when you invest internationally?
No, we don't. And you can see how wild it is right now.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, there are countries that have, that are more commodity-oriented, New Zealand, Australia, sure. Canada, that get hurt when their commodities go down. There's political risk like there was in Russia when they invaded Ukraine.
Venezuela, look what's going on.
Oh, Venezuela. Well, first of all, a lot of the middle-class Venezuela live with me in Florida now. They live in Weston. But the to say it's a tragedy, there's got to be a revolt there.
It's coming. You could see it coming.
It's got to be.
By the time this broadcasts, it'll probably be over.
Yeah, but it's, you know, no electricity. It's just no food.
They're raiding the school cafeterias for food because people don't have any food.
The schools, everything's breaking down. It's truly. And then, of course, the oil's predominantly heavy sour crude no one wants. Mm-hmm. The refinery blew up. And the only way they can sell that stuff is to refine it. You know, that's why Saudi and Kuwait have their own refineries.
Right.
Because no one wants their heavy sour stuff unless they refine it. Anyway, it's just you got to get the currency right. And emerging markets, going back to risk, do balance out a big diversified portfolio and are getting a bigger share because they're zigging when other things zag.
Right.
So the models are calling for more of that right now.
So let's that's really interesting. Let's go with the last question before I get to my favorites, which is how different is managing other people's money from writing a newsletter?
It's not that different. You know, it's funny, the SEC will never let us clone a newsletter for management. So they never quite match, okay?
Why is that? You can't just turn it into an ETF or something like that?
Correct. Well, it's obviously regulatory rulings, but there was a manager near me in Jupiter, Florida, that was cloning his newsletter, and he got fined $2.3 million. So we just noticed that. Okay. So what I do?
I didn't even know there was such a rule.
Because the newsletter's not permitted marketing material. So if I ever had a newsletter touching my management material, I'm really bad. Okay. Uh-huh. So that is why. The management is headquartered in Reno, Nevada.
I got
it. And publishing's in Rockville, Maryland. We've tried to separate them.
Never the twain shall meet.
Correct. And so, but the truth of the matter is there's obviously a tremendous overlap. We have different names. So large cap might overlap my blue chip letter, but it might have a 70-80% overlap, but they don't match and they have different names. I have different managers on it. And so we do try to differentiate it, but in the end, the clients come to us for that good risk-adjusted performance. The way our system really works is we keep 60% in conservative stocks, 30% moderately aggressive, 10% aggressive, and as things get more volatile, we start to trim or sell outright. And a lot of people will take the newsletters and they'll try it, and they forget to trim. Right. And they come to us when markets are narrow. So this is a great time for our business because the markets aren't easy, and it is very narrow. And they really want our help with the risk controls. And then we have to dial in on taxes. If it's a pension, we might chase more of our A-rated stocks. If it's a tax-efficient account, we might buy A's or B's. Or if they're in a high-tax state, we might put them in a growing fund. But we always have to blend in the dividend management because it zigs when the other stuff zags, the growth stock zag. And it's really about dialing in and getting everybody as smooth as possible. And, of course, as people get older, they want more income. And we can make that transition very easily. So we're really proud of our private client group, and we enjoy working with people. And we treat everybody like family. That's what we try to do.
All right, so let's jump into our standard questions. We ask all our guests, and let's start right with mentors. Who were some of the early mentors who influenced your thought process about investing?
Professor Sharp at Stanford wrote a little book that was religious reading to me, very short.
What was the name of Sharp's book?
I have no idea. It was red, and it had all the formulas in there I needed.
And this is Nobel laureate Bill Sharp.
He's in his 90s now.
Who was the advisor for Financial Engines, which is now running about $150 billion.
Financial Engines, very, very successful. I had the honor of meeting Harry Markowitz in Tahoe once, and Harry's a great guy. One of my professors, Arnold Langston, who's in his 90s now, was buddies with Harry and likes to call Bill Sharp every now and then. But you know, those were the people that gave me the formulas, and I just set out to document it. there are efficiently priced stocks out there, and mm-hmm. then there are things that are not efficiently priced. So what I don't care how many anomalies there are, I just want to find them. And basically I'm saying a lot of the market is efficient now, whether that's ETFs or indexing, but I just care about the inefficient ones. And those are the ones that Russell's going to be adding their indices popping. Those are the ones that are reacting positive to their earnings or growing dividends. But it is shockingly narrow. Our dividend grader, you got to be in the top 11%. Our stock grader, you got to be in the top 9%. That's how tight the markets are at this time.
So those are academic mentors. How about investors? What specific investors have affected the way you think?
James Stewart is at American Century, was obviously very influential. He was one of the original...
James Stalwart.
Stowers. He was one of the original... earnings momentum guys. He was American Century in Kansas City. He was buying research from BJ Young in San Francisco. I remember meeting those guys. See, I did all this pre-computers. Okay, mm-hmm. I did it on calculators, and then obviously I tried to stay on the head of automation. And those guys were we watched. We also watched the Peter Lynch's of the world. I think Peter Lynch. You know, I know he told a story and all that stuff, but there was a lot of math there. In fact, I did it when I was pretty young. I did a report for Fidelity on my quant stuff. So
Peter Lynch is a closet quant, in other words.
Well, he had some other people there. That there was a guy named Rich Fenton that seemed to be more of a quant, and he was a good mentor for that whole team at Fidelity. And but you know, it's you get to a size where you can only manage so much money, and Fidelity's at that size. And but
has been for a long time.
Remember Ned, the Rand Fidelity was a pretty
Ned
good
Johnson.
Ned was a pretty good manager
now
himself.
Now it's Abigail Johnson, yeah. His daughter's yeah. running it. Ned Johnson was running a fund back in the early
yeah,
days.
Yeah, pre Peter Lynch, it was pretty successful too.
Huh. So you mentioned Bill Sharpe's book. What other books have been influential?
After that, it was just IBD and staying on the cutting edge. I don't agree with how to exit, like IBD says. I wouldn't set a stop at 7% or anything.
Right.
But
you're guaranteed to get taken out of stocks that are going much
higher
with that number.
In fact, you know, because of our volatility last August, you know, the New York Stock Exchange banned physical stops and GTCs for 2 months, and that's mm-hmm. how bad it was. But yeah, you never show anybody your order. You never show them your cards. But,
I learned that early in my career. Yeah. If you put a stop out there, somehow a specialist will get the price there, take it, and then move it away.
Correct. And I have three good ex-traders that work for me. They aren't trading now. They try to educate everybody. But the truth of the matter is the markets are always mutating, and you just got to stay on top of it. And I don't like any theme that doesn't make money. I do like them when they make the transition from negative to positive earnings. If I can time it that quarter, I like that because it's explosive. But most of the time,
the change from negative to positive earnings.
I like that. But most of my stocks most of my stocks are going in a very smooth, steady manner. There's relentless buying pressure and buybacks under the surface. There's growing dividends. And so I jump on them as long as I can ride them, and they're safe. And then eventually they get more erratic for whatever reason. Margins are under compression, or buybacks are slowing down, or the sector's going out of favor. I had this experience last year. You know, I had Gilead, which is the hepatitis C pill. I would get grief on that because Hillary said the pill's too expensive, and I would argue it's a cure for hepatitis. It's cheaper than dying a painful death in the hospital. So leave Gilead alone.
But just to clarify, this is cheaper than dying a long, slow, painful death in a hospital.
Yes, yes.
And all right, so check that box
okay.
off.
Okay, and then... But you know, they start to hit the biotech funds, they start to hit the pharma funds because Hillary was picking on the healthcare stocks. You know, I had to sell Allergan. Mm-hmm. I said, Hillary's not going to mess with Allergan, it's Botox, okay? You know, and we're very familiar with Botox in South Florida. You can see who has it because they're drooling at the cocktail parties. The dentists do Botox in South Florida mandatory. At least I think that's the thing. You have to tell them not to do Botox, okay, if you don't want it.
You have to opt out.
Yes, yes. Anyway, to make a long story short, you know, there are sectors that get hit because they're in a big basket. You know, they do throw the baby out with the bathwater. When we had the big energy meltdown, you know, we said, well, I don't know if they'll hit the terminals, the pipelines, and the frackers.
Yeah, they hit it's across the board.
Yeah, yeah. And, well, then the earnings would come out, and one side would have earnings, others. But then it was just too long, and then they took everything out. I remember there was one LED lighting company that was in an energy ETF, so they took it out because it was in the wrong ETF. Okay, because it made LED lighting. Okay?
We see all sorts of people confuse symbols. news comes out and a similar symbol gets whacked.
Yeah.
I mean, the behavioral side of it is really quite amazing.
What I like, how, is no one can read the second sentence. Okay.
Everybody
just reads the headline and you trade off the headline. And then you can have a correction and no one cares. No one's programmed to trade off corrections, to my knowledge, yet.
That's amazing. So you mentioned a lot of the things that have changed since you joined the industry. What do you think is the most significant changes? What, if you had to pick one thing, what has had the greatest impact on investing?
Decimalization.
Really?
Yeah.
So going from teenies and quarters and eighths to decimalization, that changed the research equation, didn't it?
Yes. I missed the old system. I preferred the old system. I preferred getting on NASDAQ level 3,
mm-hmm.
Calling market makers, cleaning out their inventory, accumulating stocks, never moving them. Today, I deal with an algorithm. I deal with an anonymous high-frequency trading system, and I don't like it. We calculate something called unsystematic risk, the risk we can't diversify away. In large-cap stocks, it's about 0.6% of trade.
Really?
In mid-cap stocks, it's 1.8%. In small-cap, it's still running almost 600 basis points of trade.
Wow.
ETFs last August were 458. Now they're 357.
Basis points of, so about 3.5%.
This is unsystematic risk, the static, the fudge factor, how much they might pick you off if you're careless with your order.
Right.
And so when we optimize a portfolio, we have to get the lowest beta possible.
Mm-hmm.
We have to get the unsystematic risk down, and we get the alpha as high as possible, and there's ways to optimize. But the unsystematic risk exploded when they decimalized the market. I like the old system. The fact that Europe is gone in August, the fact that most of my friends here in New York are gone in the second half of August.
Right.
I hate August. I just hate it. Okay. Now, in a presidential election year, often it's better because we're all being distracted by the conventions.
Right.
Apparently,
which are in July this year.
Correct. But I think the rhetoric will be pretty hot and heavy in the summer. I personally, as long as Trump and Hillary are sucking up to people, that's good. I'm waiting for them to start sucking up to people. Okay. Normally, we rally going to presidential election year because of the suck up factor. It lifts consumer confidence, rubs off investor confidence. But I know this is not a conventional election year, but I would hope that they would make August a little smoother this time. I know it'll be entertaining as can be, but it's I would like to see a little suck up with the attacks.
I love that. Our last two questions. So if a millennial or some recent college graduate came to you and said, Louis, I'm thinking about a career in finance, what sort of advice would you give them?
Well, I'll tell you the same thing I told my son. You better take a psychology class because the market is a manic crowd. That is what behavioral finance is. We're studying crowds and we're locking in on what they like. And crowd movement will last for several months. And so we want to lock in on it, if not years. Second thing is better take an accounting class. If you have any criticism of all the CFAs out there, they're all trained to track. They're all trained to hug these benchmarks, throw out a few dogs if they want to try to beat it. And everybody's forgotten about accounting, okay? And they better learn finance. There's the number of investors out there that have no idea what a P ratio is or, you know, it's incredible. You know, we deal with this because we have Tesla in Reno. You know, they're building the battery mm-hmm. plant, and I deal with it in California. And they're all in La La Land. I don't think they have any idea of the risk they're incurring with that stock right now.
Huh, quite fascinating. And the last question, what is it that you know about investing today that you wish you knew when you started out in 1980?
Well, that's a very good point. You know, you have to read the credit markets because the credit markets influence the stock market. But I think it's the credit market meltdown in 2008, that's the most profound. What happened on Wall Street is it started to leverage debt. And this is a good closing point. I obviously live in South Florida. Bernie was up the street. Six mm-hmm. homes south of me was a guy named Tom Petter, still $3.8 billion faking commercial paper. My neighbors were...
Bernie isn't Bernie Madoff.
Bernie was up the street.
I thought we were talking Bernie... Sanders.
No.
Bernie Madoff was up the street.
Up the street.
Okay, sure.
And then... Tom Petters was Six Home South. Me, still $3.8 billion, fake and commercial pay for 18 years. I belong to a golf club where the founder of this big, fancy fund of funds only recommended Bernie and Petters.
That worked out well.
Well, he has no standard deviation because everybody's lost their money, and there is some upside because the attorney general's recover. But my neighbors got wiped out more by leverage debt.
Really?
Things like the Falcons.
More than the Madoffs of the
correct.
World.
Correct. Well, might be the club I belong to. But the bottom line is they were leveraged in AA-rated munis, 8-1, the Falcon funds.
Oh, my goodness.
And they lost 97% of their money. This is part of the credit default swap problem and collapsing. And so anytime I see leveraged debt, I freak out, okay? And I see
good
a little
response.
I see a little now 2-1. Obviously, we had the SIV problem. That was 10-1. That was our bet on the yield curve. That's what sunk Bear Stearns and Lehman. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But the thing that shocks me to this day is the guy that led the Falcon funds, who lost $21.1 billion for Citibank. He obviously got fired over this whole mess.
That'll show him.
And he finally got a new job. And and he's a very controversial guy. Anyway, his name is Jack Lew.
And he is
our Treasury Secretary
of the United States. Yeah. So that SIV grouping lost how much money for Citibank?
The SIVs was the big fiasco, and that was a whole nother matter. But Jack Lew, to my knowledge, was doing the leveraged munis.
Munis
Falcon
at Citi.
Funds. Correct. And that got Sally Krawcheck fired, and then he lost his job too, because his little division lost $21.1 billion. Plus, you had the SIV loss on top of it. Obviously, somebody at Citi called Robert Rubin, and Citi was deemed too big to fail and got bailed out.
To say the least.
But it's shocking to me how you can blow up people and then get a new
Treasury
job.
Treasury Secretary. That's amazing. I knew that Citigroup was toast long before they actually hit the floor, but I had no idea the losses on leveraged munis were $21 billion. That's a huge, huge number.
That was the Falcon funds. That was a munis leverage 8-1. Mm-hmm. Everybody loved them. In fact, I still remember I went to a party in Palm Beach, and everybody's bragging how much money they're
Falcon
making.
Falcon funds.
Yeah.
You can 8-1. Well, leverage is great as long as it's going your direction. As soon as the market goes the other direction, you're completely
toast. And I do have a bond business, and my bond guy worked at AIG, mm-hmm. and he tells a funny story that when they kicked Hank Greenberg out of his own firm, because he liked Hank, and they put in this auto insurance guy to run AIG, they wrote all these credit default swaps at bogus rates because they really wanted a bonus. Mm. So my bond guy actually blames the government for blowing up AIG, okay? And the collapse of the credit default swap market. But, you know, the bond market's wild. It's been wild this year with you've seen in high yield. And so I wish I knew a little bit more about the bond market. You know, I keep friends in the bond market. I talk to them all the time. They're just a wreck most of the time, I'll be honest with you. I mean, they're a wreck. I mean, this is not an easy job. So us stock guys, I think, have a lot easier job than these credit guys.
See, I look at the bond side as, what's the big deal? Here's your duration. Here's your coupon. Here's your risk. That stuff practically runs. I once had a conversation with Paul McCulley. Yeah. Hey, that stuff practically runs itself. What are you guys having so much angst out in PIMCO?
We have a bond business. We play in the triple B era.
That's a whole different.
So our neighborhood's a lot safer than the other neighborhoods. But it's, the distressed debt world is fascinating. And that's where I get all the good Trump stories, okay? Because Trump would beat you up to get 40 cents on the dollar.
Right.
Then he's your best friend.
Right.
Okay. So the theory is, if he did become president, I realize it's not, we don't know yet, but if he did become president, I'm sure he's going to cut deals with everybody. I mean, that's what he did in business.
Well, but yeah. I can't imagine him cutting a deal saying, okay, everybody who's holding U.S. treasuries, we're going to give you 60 cents on the dollar, and that's how we're going to solve our deficit. That comment, I think, isn't going to fly.
No, but we do have a joke, and this is a joke. I want to be clear. And we used to joke that it's easy to get rid of our deficit. All we have to do is refinance it in negative yielding tips, and our problem went away.
Can I tell you something? I don't think that's so much of a joke. I think you look not too far off in the future. That's a real possibility. Certainly 50-year bonds when the U.S. goes to zero rate are not unthinkable. That's one way to rethink it. By the way, I think the government did help cause AIG to blow up, but in a different way than you realize. Enron had been agitating for the Commodity Futures Monetization Act to get passed, which basically took all those derivatives out of the normal no reserve requirements, no exchange listings, no counterparty disclosures, no just transparency, and AIG wrote $3 trillion worth of them. It was just a non... That started when Hank was there with sure. AIG FP.
Sure.
There should be some reasonable amount of regulation to prevent us from our own worst demons, not an excessive amount of regulation that hamstrings us and prevents us from opening new businesses. That is the never-ending battle. AIG ended up seeing an opening, and they said, the quote from AIG FP's president was, "It's free money. You just write premiums and count the cash running in."
You know, that's what we say about cover call writing. Don't you want the free money? And
right.
it makes sense in a choppy washing machine market, but sure. if you get in a strong rip-roaring bull market, everything's going to get called away.
Right.
So there are these windows out there, but as a
people extrapolate them to infinity, as opposed to saying this is a temporary cycle and
correct.
Eventually the world
and
turns.
And as a stock guy, I want to have friends on the credit side. I want to understand what's going on out there because I need to see what's happening. And I respect those guys because I think that's a very, very stressful business. And
The best stock guys always come with some form of a credit background.
But as we close here, here's the ultimate irony. The winner in the low interest rate environment are stocks because everybody's borrowing in the bond market, buying their stock back. The multinationals can borrow in Europe and other places even cheaper than can borrow here. And so the stock market is actually dying on us. So my average stock is going to be gone in 14 years from buybacks. And the S&P at the current buyback pace might be gone in 27, 28 years.
So obviously that can't go on forever.
That's why the market's melting up. It's melting up on order imbalances. It's going up on light volume. It's really, really eerie. But as long as the dividends are higher than the treasuries, I think people should go there.
How could you not? Louis, this has been fantastic. Thank you for being so generous with your time. And I would be remiss if I did not say Vonnie Quinn said to say hello.
Great.
I know you guys know each other from way back when. Let me thank my recording engineer, Reggie, my producer, Charlie Vollmer. Taylor Riggs is our booker. Mike Batnick is the head of research. If you have enjoyed this conversation, be sure and look up an inch or down an inch on Apple iTunes, and you can see any of the other 96 or so such conversations that we've had. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
Brought to you by BASF. We create chemistry.